Carrie Peck, the elder law attorney. They marvel at and enjoy his personality. Hello, Mr. Peck.
Hi, John. Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
The elder law attorney with the sparkling personality, and I'm not kidding when I say that. As we talk about mental health, as we talk about elder law, that's the specialty. And since you and I spoke last, Carrie, it was the Alzheimer's Association of Illinois that asked you to sort of spearhead an education program for them. Is that right?
That is correct, John. I'm very pleased to report that the Alzheimer's Association has asked us to teach legal education classes to people throughout the Illinois region, and we're happy to put together both legal education programs that, of course, incorporate the devastating impact of Alzheimer's disease on not just the patient, the person diagnosed with Alzheimer's, but the family. It's really a joint effort between the family and the patient, and so we're partnering up with the Alzheimer's Association to get this project off the ground and to teach folks how to deal with the legal impact of this devastating illness.
Give me a hint on that. What do you tell people about that?
Well, we tell people, particularly if it's early in the disease, depending on what the doctor says, and this is an effort between both the legal community and the medical community, if a doctor diagnoses an individual with Alzheimer's disease, and they still have the capacity to do estate planning documents, then they should promptly do estate planning documents, as fast as possible. And those initially, of course, would be what we call advanced directives or powers of attorney. A power of attorney for health care, in which an individual names someone to make decisions for them regarding the management of their health care when they're not able to do that. And we know definitively that when someone is diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, it's a progressive disease.
Yeah.
And if they're diagnosed early enough on and can still do documents, they're definitely going to need a decision maker later on in the progress of this terrible illness. In addition, we ask people to nominate a decision maker regarding the management of their assets, their property, their bank accounts. For the same reasons, we know that this disease is not getting better. It's getting worse, and it's going to affect people's mental abilities to make decisions. And likewise, of course, if they're capable, we want them to do wills. We want them to do potentially revocable living trusts. We want them to get their legal house in order if the doctor gives the go-ahead that they have the capacity to do so. Unfortunately, in many circumstances, the patients are diagnosed too far into the illness and no longer have the capacity to make decisions regarding who's going to be in charge of basically their lives, their health care, and their assets when they're not capable of making those decisions. And that really leaves us only with one option, and that's necessarily to go into the circuit court of whatever county they reside in, Cook, Lake, McHenry, et cetera, and ask the court to appoint a court-appointed guardian, which can be a loved one, a spouse, a child, a close family member. And then that process is then subject to the supervision of the court. So there are several, prompt decisions that need to be made. And I tell folks, clearly when a loved one is diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, number one is doctors. Number one is medical. Number one is, what's the prognosis? Should we take medication? But number two is legal. Get on it right away, because the passage of time does not help the situation.
You can, though, appoint a power of attorney for medical or financial even before or without having been diagnosed, right?
100%. And I would encourage all of your listeners, while competent, please make it decisions regarding who's going to manage your assets. And people normally go, oh, Carrie, I don't need that. I'm not old. Well, let's change the fact and imagine that you're out on the Stevenson or the Kennedy and you get slaughtered in an accident. You won't have already decided who's going to make decisions regarding your health care management and your asset management. Make those decisions while you're capable in advance of the necessity.
Does that include, I don't know what they call it, end-of-life decisions? That is, if I can no longer have a meaningful existence if I'm alive but maybe in a coma, I want to give somebody the power to turn off whatever life support I have. Are we talking about that sort of thing too, Carrie?
We are. We are, John. And you can make those kind of decisions in conjunction with a power of attorney for health care. And certainly people bring to the table a lot of different beliefs, many religious and some less than religious, in terms of end-of-life decision-making. But yes, those are critically important questions. You raise a really, really good point. I'm sure your listeners all have read about or heard about or even experienced someone who is in the throes of an ultimately life-ending event, and decisions have to be made regarding, are they going to have operations? Are they going to be on feeding tubes? Mm-hmm. Are they going to be on, you know, life-sustaining procedures and devices that may extend life but may not improve the quality?
Well, what happens if
these are very controversial areas?
What happens if the family members don't all agree on that? Mom or dad's, I won't dwell on some description of them, but now we need to make a decision about, do we keep them on some life-sustaining machine, or do we hope that they're going to get better, they're going to rebound? And some of the siblings say A, and some of the siblings say B. What happens then, Carrie?
Well, it ends up in the courtroom, and I have litigated those cases, many of those cases, the right to die or end of life death cases, and they're all very, very, very contentious. They're very emotional. They're very ugly. As I mentioned earlier, they involve frequently religion, ethics, morality. We've had witnesses that, you know, are priests and rabbis and people from all different walks of life. I litigated a Jehovah's Witness case. So these are all scenarios that if you want to avoid them, and you can avoid them, make the decisions while you're competent to make those decisions, because they end up in the courtroom and everybody's lives are spilled on the courtroom floor emotionally.
So I think it's also interesting that you describe, say, in the cases of Alzheimer's, I presume you also include dementia in that umbrella, Carrie? Are we talking about dementia also?
Yes, John. We are including dementia in that umbrella. Many people term the Alzheimer's diagnosis somewhat less sometimes as dementia. Yeah. Dementias could come as a result of oxygenation issues. There are a variety of forms of dementia.
Okay, here's why I bring that up, Carrie. So then say the doctor has diagnosed mom or dad with dementia or Alzheimer's, but they are, so the diagnosis is there, but since it's a slow process, they're still able to make a conscious decision about some of these things, right? It's not the kids deciding, it's not the courts deciding. Mom or dad, having been diagnosed, can still be judged competent to make the calls on some of these issues, right?
On some of these issues, the answer is yes, they can. But it's entirely up to the doctor. The doctor's going to have to tell the lawyer, can mom make those decisions? Can dad still sign a document directing that child number one, the son, is going to be in charge of decisions? It's really a determination from the doctor's viewpoint. Can this individual make competent decisions?
You know, it's frustrating is that sometimes those people with dementia or Alzheimer's early on, they have moments of clarity and they have moments where they're utterly confused. And it depends on which version of them you happen to get at that time. But I've seen it where you think they're quite capable and other times incapable at all, you know?
Well, as you know, John, and you certainly aptly point out, you know, there are days when people have some clarity and there are days when they have none, depending on the nature of their illness. And sometimes they're able to fool some of the people some of the time. And that's kind of the old phrase. But it's a tricky area and it's kind of a slippery slope. The medical community and the legal community need to work, hand in glove to help these folks out and protect them.
You know, and it's so easy to impose your own wishes, desires, feelings, philosophies on that person. For instance, were it me, if I'm fairly incapacitated, nobody needs to keep me around. I've had a nice long life, and I don't need to be around anymore as a medical or financial burden to anybody. So I don't. I would advise y'all to just unplug me and be done with it, and have enjoyed the good time we had together. And I think I could make that judgment for somebody else, but but I guess it's not my judgment to make, you know, Carrie. So that's the way I would like to live. And I also think everybody would be better off if I were to impose that on you. But I know I'm not of rights to do that either.
Well, I think that you raise a good point. And I think that's why it's so important that people are able to analyze that situation when they're rational, when they're not afflicted with an illness that's going to impact that. Because don't forget, these decisions have to be made not just for people that suffer from Alzheimer's disease or dementia. These decisions need to be made for people that suffer from physical maladies, lung issues, heart issues. And, you know, at what point do I want to be resuscitated? At what point do I want to remain on life support or life-sustaining treatment?
Sure.
And I can tell you, John, that sometimes people change their opinion as they get closer to D-Day.
Well, as is their right, I would say. But, you know, so if you're 30 years old, and this is not on your near horizon, who knows what, like you said, you might get in a crash, and now you're incapacitated too. So as a 30-year-old makes out their will or estate plan, do you have them then, at that point, at the age of 30, figure out who would have power of attorney for them over these issues?
The answer is unequivocally yes.
Wow.
But let's be clear. These documents can be changed.
Yeah.
They can, you know, the relationships change. Yeah. I mean, you talk about people that, for example, get divorced. Obviously, they're naming each other to make those decisions. They get divorced. The documents, boom, gone. We do new documents.
Now, what
so as people age, as you point out, their views change.
And I wonder what happens if you got divorced and then you forgot to do that, and the power of attorney has your spouse, who you might be married to somebody else now. I presume those documents would sort of...
those documents would be, you know, ultimately deemed revoked. You know, there's no direct provision, but nobody's going to try and enforce those documents. And if they do, they're going nowhere.
Okay. Carrie, can I just read you a couple of texts real quick?
Of course.
Hey, John Williams, I'm so happy my mom had a will, advanced directive, and a trust. My sisters wanted to keep her alive, and I had to fight for my mom's right to leave this world as she wanted. The documents made it easier. I don't understand those people who have mom in a hospital. The documents say she should pass. She says she wants to pass. She's not going to live well. Let her go. And the sisters wouldn't do it. That's not a question, well, is it, Carrie? But it's a scenario, and I guess you see that all the time, huh?
We've seen it all the time, John, and it's an ugly scenario, and it's a scenario that if a family can agree to avoid it, please avoid it. You know, do the documents. When mom makes a decision, let her decision stand.
And then honor the document. This is Barb. You're on WGN with Carrie Peck. Whoops, hit the wrong button. Stand by. There you are, Barb. Thanks for joining us. You're on WGN.
Hi. I have a will, and I have the POAs, but I've also, when my brother passed away 2 years ago, we didn't have time to put, he had a will because we didn't have time to do the estate. And I'm trying to find out, when do you do an estate, a trust, and when do you do a will?
Well, in large measure, the purpose of using a living trust, a revocable living trust, is to avoid the necessity of opening up a post-death probate estate. And a probate estate in Illinois is required when someone dies with assets in their name alone, and I'm saying on purpose, in their name alone, meaning not joint tenancy or other methods of ownership, in excess of $100,000. So the law requires we open a court proceeding post-death if someone dies with assets in their name in excess of $100,000. In general, the use of a revocable living trust is to avoid that probate proceeding, because we put the assets into the trust during lifetime, and they pass under the terms of the trust, avoiding the court proceeding. So that's kind of a quick overview.
I'll let you call his office. I'll give you the number if you want more information. John, my nieces and nephews have children, but they don't have wills or a trust. What can be done? It must be frustrating when you see people who should do this and they just won't get around to it.
You know, I think the only thing you can really do is encourage them to do it, encourage them to take a look at maybe the circumstances that they know of, a family, a friend,
right,
a neighbor, you know, that had problems. And this is a method of avoiding them.
Carrie's initial consultation is free. You can call 312-201-0900 or click on peckritchie.com. Nice to talk to you, Carrie. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, John. Great to be here. Bye-bye now.